denial. If we know nothing about a partner's other activities, we will find it difficult to make informed choices about our relationship, particularly the sexual aspects. Don't ask, don't tell relationships put outside lovers in an unenviable position too. Often such relationships include restrictions on calling a partner at home, and they almost always preclude visiting a partner's home, much less meeting the other partner to check on how this setup is sitting with them. Demanding to know everything undermines intimacy, but so does demanding to know nothing. When we demand to know nothing, we cut ourselves off from a part of our partner's experience, and that must necessarily limit how intimate we can be. The issue always seems to circle back to these questions. How much do you trust your partners? How much do you trust your relationships? Do you trust your partners enough to allow intimacy, not limiting what you can hear? Do you trust your partners enough to leave them their private spaces, knowing that they will share things that are important and relevant to you so you can continue to make informed choices? Double standards. Rules that place different restrictions on different people are problematic in any situation, and polyamory is no exception. Double standards can be blatant and obvious. For example, Playboy founder Hugh Hefner is famous for having sexual relationships with multiple women simultaneously, all of whom are expected to have no lovers but him. But double standards can also be subtle and sneaky. A common example is when a couple has a rule stating that they can interrupt each other's dates with other partners if a member of the couple needs attention, but their other partners are not allowed to interrupt the couple's date with each other. A double standard might not even be a hardship for the person agreeing to it. If someone genuinely does not want multiple partners, for instance, and is okay with his partner having other lovers, a rule that she can but he can't would not limit him. But it's still a double standard. The rules are still different for her than for him. It also raises the question of why the rule exists. If she genuinely isn't interested in others, why was the rule imposed? Sometimes double standards are deliberately engineered to create different classes of people. If members of a couple claim the right to veto relationships with other people, but other partners are not given veto powers over the couple's relationship, a deliberate double standard exists. The couple may see this double standard as a way to prevent new partners from causing them to break up. Whenever rules apply unevenly to different people, there is potential for trouble, resentment, and jealousy. Ironically, double standards are often instituted as a way to prevent jealousy, at least within established relationships, but far more often they end up creating it. Rules that codify a double standard are disempowering. Be careful with rules that create double standards, both in setting them and, if you're starting a new relationship with someone who has them, in agreeing to them. Questions to ask yourself. When considering your needs for agreements or rules, or whether to sign on to someone else's, these questions can be useful. What needs am I trying to address with this agreement? Does the agreement offer a path to success? Does everyone affected by the agreement have the opportunity to be involved in setting its terms? How is the agreement negotiated, and under what circumstances can it be renegotiated? What happens if the agreement doesn't work for my partners or my partner's partners? Do I feel like I need rules to feel safe? If so, will the rules actually keep me safe? Are my rules equally binding on everyone they affect, or do they create a double standard? 11. Hierarchy and primary-secondary poly. You must love in such a way that the person you love feels free. Thich Nhat Hanh. Whatever your position may be in a relationship network, polyamory brings risk. We've already talked about some of the ways people try to deal with these risks, not always wisely, and the strategies we recommend. Before we go further, we want to examine some of the underlying forces that shape any relationship. We're going to simplify a lot to construct a framework that lets us get our ideas across. The three main forces we will discuss here are connection, commitment, and power. How hierarchies emerge. Connection can mean a whole bunch of things, but here it represents what people see as the exciting bits of a relationship. Intensity, passion, shared interests, sex, joy in each other's presence. It's the things that bring you together. Commitment consists of what you build in a relationship over time. It includes expectations, perhaps of continuity, reliability, shared time and communication, activities that will be done together, or a certain public image. Commitment often supports life responsibilities, such as shared finances, a home, or children. It's common for connection to start out very large and exciting and shrink as a relationship deepens and stabilizes, or sometimes to start out small, grow to a peak, and then wane. Commitment tends to start small and grow. People in long-term, very committed relationships may still struggle to maintain connection. Each of these flows, connection, commitment, gives people power in a relationship. Power tends to be proportional to the size of the other flows. The more we're committed to a relationship, and the more connected we feel to someone, the greater the power that person has to affect not only ourselves and our relationship with that person, but all our other relationships as well. Ideally, the power flows within intimate relationships would always be equal. In practice, they're often not. Power imbalances tend to arise when the other flows are asymmetrical, when one person feels more connection or commitment than another. That's normal. The people who feel less connection or commitment tend to hold on to more power. Other things influence power dynamics too, of course, like economic or social status, physical dominance or persuasion skills. When someone is in a relationship with a large mutual commitment, especially when that commitment supports a lot of life responsibilities, it's common for a member of that relationship to feel threatened when a partner's new relationship has a really big connection, perhaps one that feels, and maybe really is, bigger than the existing connection. Often, it's just the idea of a big connection that's scary, even when the flow is new and small. And the idea of a partner creating significant commitments to a new partner may feel, and sometimes is, threatening to the commitments that already exist. One way people deal with this fear is by using the power from within their own relationship to restrict the connection, commitment, or both in other relationships. Such restrictions have a couple of defining features. Authority. A person or people in one relationship, usually called the primary relationship, have the authority to restrict other relationships, often called secondary. Asymmetry. The people within the secondary relationship do not have the same authority to limit the primary relationship. When these two elements are present within a poly relationship, that relationship is hierarchical. What is hierarchy? Some people use the word hierarchy whenever one relationship has more commitments or responsibilities than another. For instance, members of a long married couple with a house and kids becoming involved with a friends with benefits. This is not how we are using the word hierarchy in this book. When we talk here about a hierarchy, we mean a very specific power dynamic where one relationship is subject to the control of someone outside that relationship. For instance, a hierarchy exists if a third party has the power to veto a relationship or limit the amount of time the people in it can spend together. You can't throw a calendar in a group of poly people without hitting the hierarchical relationship. Hierarchical behavior might take the form of a rule that no other partner may ever live with us, for example. Alternatively, it might manifest as restrictions on how strong another relationship is allowed to become or on what a new person is allowed to do, where they are allowed to go, or what they're allowed to feel. Some common examples of prescriptions in hierarchical polyamory are the primary couple always comes first, with regard to time or other resources. Each member of the primary couple can veto any secondary partner of the other. We discuss vetoes in detail in the next chapter. Members of the primary couple are not permitted to spend the night with a secondary partner. Members of the primary couple pledge to love each other the most. If the members of the primary relationship run into trouble or feel threatened, they can put secondary relationships on hold while they work things out between them. People often assume these prescriptions are okay because secondary relationships are casual, but often they are not. Some secondary relationships are emotionally serious, long-lasting, and deeply committed. Franklin's hierarchical secondary relationship with Bella lasted a decade. Nevertheless, secondary relationships are defined as relationships subordinate to a primary relationship by rules, structures, or agreements determined by the primary partners. Here is Franklin's story.
When Celeste and I first started practicing polyamory in 1988, before we had the word polyamory, neither one of us had any idea there were other people trying to do the same thing we were. Without the support of other polyamorous people, we had to make things up as we went along. We talked a great deal, trying to decide how we could do this non-monogamy thing. We tried to create rules for our relationships that we could both live with and that we thought would help us each feel secure and happy. We were so busy thinking about protecting ourselves that we didn't think about the happiness of anyone else who might become involved with us. As a result, our rules focused on our own relationship. We thought that if we preserved the relationship between the two of us, the core relationship, we were doing the right thing. We never considered that rules that worked for us might not work for the other people we would come to love. And we certainly never looked at our relationship from their perspective.
Prioritization of relationships does not necessarily imply hierarchy by our definition. For example, the two of us each have a partner, not each other, with whom we live and own property. Sharing a home means we have financial commitments that lead us to prioritize whom we spend money on. The mortgage must be paid before we spend a lot on dates. And if we start dating a new partner, that person doesn't immediately get a vote on whether we sell the house. Other examples. You probably don't give the keys to your car to someone on a first date. And most parents, mono or poly, are rightly cautious about who they introduce their young children to and when. Exercising your personal judgment in these kinds of decisions and expecting your partners to make good judgments is not displaying a hierarchy toward the person affected, nor is requiring a partner to give your consent for things that concern both of you, such as property or children. But if you control when and how your partner can make relationship decisions with others, and this prescription is intended to overrule the choices of your partner and his other partner, that is hierarchy. Children are often used to justify hierarchy. If you are co-parenting, hopefully you are co-parenting with someone whose judgment you trust and whom you trust to protect your children's interests. Deciding what parenting values you both share and will honor and setting mutually agreed expectations for shared responsibilities and the structures you will provide for the children is not imposing hierarchy per se. If the parents trust each other to make decisions within their other relationships that honor their commitments to one another and the kids. The relationship structure becomes a hierarchy, though, when one partner expects to make decisions about how the other partner will conduct their other relationships, or what level those other relationships will be permitted to reach, to ensure that the commitments to the children are, in their opinion, met. Couple focus. Hierarchy almost always focuses on a couple. The couple may explicitly choose a hierarchical model as a way to add other relationships on the side. Or they may not realize how hierarchical they will become in a pinch. But to these people, the couple is always the relationship that matters. The emphasis on a core couple can permeate a relationship in ways that are both obvious and subtle. When it is taken to its extreme, a couple may see others as simply expendable, to be ditched without warning or explanation at any sign of trouble. A lot of single poly people who became involved with a couple who they thought loved and respected them have tales to tell about abrupt loss of all contact, phone calls, and emails unanswered and no further communication. Here's Franklin's story.
Celeste's family had a Christmas tradition. Every year her entire family, no matter how far flung, would get together at her parents' house for the holiday celebration. Because she and I were married, we both attended, and because she was closeted about polyamory to her family, we never considered inviting any of my other partners, or even asking them what they might like to do for the holiday. I was simply unavailable to them, regardless of what they wanted. Far from being something that it was negotiated, this situation was a given. Celeste and I didn't think to ask whether my other partners might want to spend time with me over the holidays, so I was blind to the idea that this might matter to them at all. We had other, more far-reaching rules. At the beginning of our relationship, Celeste and I decided that no other partners would be allowed to live with us, that I would not love anyone else as much as I loved Celeste, that I would never say I love you to any other partner, and that I would never share finances with anyone else. We didn't consciously decide to ignore the needs or happiness of any secondary partners. We didn't think about them at all. We never considered, what if someone wants to live with us? Or, what if being forbidden to tell someone I love her hurts her?
People in hierarchical primary relationships may view a secondary partner's needs or expectations as a problem, or even imagine that future secondary partners should not have needs or expectations at all. If they even think that far, as with Franklin and Celeste, the happiness of the secondary partner may not even have occurred to them. The members of a primary couple may have a belief, even a tacit, almost unconscious belief, that having more than one primary partner is not possible. Many new polyamorous people believe you can only have one primary partner, as in the monogamy ideal. They believe when push comes to shove, you can really only love one person. This model might be called polyamory as modified monogamy, including the idea that you can only have one soulmate while still having multiple lovers. Reasons for hierarchy. In many ways, polyamory can be disruptive, and hierarchy can seem like a way to keep that disruption at bay. In our overwhelmingly monogamous culture, hierarchy can seem like a way to protect ourselves from risk by creating an agreement that our partner will always consider us more important than anyone else. For many people, hierarchy creates a powerful feeling of safety and control. Hierarchy also seems to promise stability and continuity. It can seem like a way to explore a radical new relationship style without giving up the comfort and certainty promised by monogamy. It also seems to promise that we can have multiple relationships while still ensuring all our needs are met. If we need something, we'll get it. Only after our needs are satisfied may secondary partners have our partner's time and attention. Hierarchy may also feel like a way of buffering ourselves from our partner's other relationships. By packaging these up and keeping them at arm's length from the core couple, we may try to prevent them from affecting the life we have. Outside of polyamory, the hierarchical model can sometimes work fine. The world of swinging is much larger than the poly world, and emotionally monogamous hierarchical couples tend to dominate there. The focus is on sex for fun and adventure, with no emotional spillover allowed into the rest of life. If you have a partner, and the two of you as a couple are strongly drawn to a hierarchical style, swinging may be an alternative to polyamory you might choose to investigate. But the waters of poly are deeper, and for loving relationships, depths need to be allowed, threatening as it may sometimes seem. When we have been in an existing relationship for a long time, we might feel like some of the early intensity has faded. Watching a partner enter a wildly passionate, starry-eyed, intensely sexual new relationship can be quite uncomfortable. New relationship energy has quite a reputation in this regard. The existing partner may feel insecure enough to impose hierarchy to try and limit the intensity for his own comfort. You can see the smoldering fuses that this move sets. The assumption lurking beneath a desire for hierarchy is that we can't really trust our partners to act well without a set of rules, that without a formal ranking to remind our partners that we come first, we will lose our status, lose the things we most value about our relationship, lose our sense of security, or even lose the relationship entirely. But as we've said before, if your partner can't be trusted to work with you on your needs, when asked, she probably can't be trusted to follow rules. The power dynamics of hierarchy. In a hierarchical relationship, by our definition, power is diverted from within one relationship to restrict another relationship, forming a sort of gate to limit commitment or connection. When the natural flow of connection or commitment is smaller than the width of that gate, everything is fine. This is usually what's going on where people point to hierarchical polygroups in which prescribed roles are working well for everyone involved. Of course, if the natural connection and commitment are small enough to fit within the gate, hierarchy probably isn't necessary. That relationship would remain where it is on its own. Problems arise when the natural flows are bigger than the gate. They won't shrink on their own, much as we might wish they would, so they continue to push back on the gate. The restriction might stifle or eventually kill the new relationship, stunting its growth, in the way a sunshine-loving plant growing under the shade of a big tree becomes stunted. But if the flows are too powerful, they will eventually crash through the gate, often causing great damage to the relationship that the power originally emanated from. Monogamous, one true soulmate conditioning goes very deep, and it's hard to root out all the ways it influences our thinking. It's hard work to consider the implications of our decisions on unknown future partners, and it's very tempting not to do that work. And it's particularly difficult to consider someone else's needs when we're scared. So it is often true that people in hierarchical relationships may behave in ways that are unnecessarily cruel to some partners, not out of malice, but merely out of thoughtlessness. Returning to our garden analogy, you could think of a relationship about to be opened up as a big tree with deep roots, maybe one that's been bearing fruit for many years, seen a few rough seasons, and spread its branches. Then you plant another seed in your garden, a new relationship. You don't know what the seed will grow into, but if you're like many primary partners, there's a good chance you have some hope, spoken or unspoken, that it will be an annual, or stay small, or at least thrive in the shade of that big tree. Certainly, it won't ever get as big or demand as much space, right? We tend to think of our secondary relationships as new relationships, without giving thought to the fact that they might endure for years. It's common to hear variations on this theme. But you can't expect a new partner to have the same rights as a spouse. True, but relationships don't stay new forever. There was a time when your spouse of 15 years was your new girlfriend or boyfriend, and a time that could come when your relationship with that new partner will also be established. Sure, it's possible that you'll want the same kind of relationship in 15 years that you wanted at 6 months, but it's unlikely. Yet couples often seem to hope and keep secondary relationships frozen at that 6 month size and shape forever. It doesn't work that way. If you plant an acorn in a flower pot and the sapling manages to survive, you'll just end up with a broken flower pot. Often primary couples manage this structural flaw by simply jettisoning any relationship that threatens to grow bigger than the space they allotted to it. Many people often implicitly assume that a secondary relationship that becomes too well-established may threaten the primary relationship, which is odd, considering the primary relationship has already had the time and energy to grow deep roots. Commonly, a second partner will sense that his happiness is not that big a concern to the primary couple, even if he can't put his finger on why. He may be sensing that even though the couple have never actually been callous or unethical, the structure of the relationship itself may not respect his rights and feelings or give his relationship space to grow. This is Franklin's story.
Over time, the agreements I had made with Celeste became painful to my other partners. A year or so after I started dating Amber, one of the things that she wanted was to live with me. Celeste and I didn't know what to do. We didn't have a way to handle a situation where another relationship grew to the point where it threatened to overrun the limits we had placed on it. As a result, when Amber mentioned the idea of living with me, Celeste perceived this as an attempt to undermine her place in my life. I thought it was most important to keep my agreements, whatever the cost. That meant I hurt the people I loved and who loved me unfairly and unnecessarily. All this pain could have been avoided if I had simply thought about the agreements from someone else's point of view before I made them. Amber eventually did move in with us, after other events discussed in the next chapter led to an attempt at greater flexibility in my and Celeste's relationship.
Ironically, hierarchy can create precisely the situation the primary couple is trying to avoid. A person who feels relegated to a subordinate position may demand more decision-making power or more freedom to grow in the relationship. These demands may feel hostile to the primary couple. They respond by tightening the restrictions or reminding the secondary partner, "Hey, you agreed to all these rules when you signed on," which only makes the secondary partner feel more disempowered. And the next thing you know, what could have been a positive and healthy relationship ends up eating itself in a big ball of suck. Another danger unique to hierarchical relationships is that a secondary partner might start a new relationship with someone else, someone who does not subscribe to hierarchy, and that new relationship can feel threatening to the partner in the primary relationship, not because it's a threat to the couple, but because the new relationship offers things the hierarchical relationship forbids. Franklin's relationship with Ruby, described in Chapter 8, is a perfect example of how this can happen. and we've both seen it many times. People in hierarchical relationships typically find that letting a secondary partner have other partners is scarier than letting their primary partner have others. Not everyone uses primary and secondary. The words primary and secondary to refer to partners first became popular among early generation poly people. Some people even had tertiary partners. Often these adjectives got pressed into service as nouns themselves, so people had primaries and secondaries. In many places, these words remain popular, and it's still fairly common to hear people talk about primary relationships. But the word secondary is falling out of favor, although some people simply use non-primary instead. This language can get confusing, because not everyone who uses the words primary and secondary is talking about a hierarchical relationship. The confusion arises because these words may be used in two different ways. Prescriptively, as when a primary couple decides in advance what limitations any other relationship will be subject to, or descriptively, to describe whether a relationship has naturally grown to be more or less entangled than another. For example, some people use primary to refer to all live-in relationships and secondary for all relationships that aren't financially or domestically entwined. As well, hierarchical polyamorous often, well, not always, expect that there can only be one primary relationship, whereas with descriptive primary-secondary relationship, some people have several primary partners. We've even heard people who practice non-hierarchical poly say, "My primary is whichever partner I'm with at the time," even if it's more than one partner. Neither one of us describes any of our relationships as primary or secondary, and neither do our partners, their partners, or most of our close associates. Many poly people have made the choice not to do this, and they tend to find that words such as partner, lover, girlfriend, boyfriend, fiancé, and spouse convey more meaning than the words primary and secondary. The two of us call the people we live with nesting partners. Some people also refer to domestic partners. Co-parent and life partner are also commonly used. We've also heard life mate. Friend is sometimes used for casual lovers, as in, "He's my, friend." Many poly people, including us, refer to all their partners as sweeties or loves, and the term paramour, from which metamour is derived, is popular in the United Kingdom. There are plenty of made-up terms and phrases too. You may have noticed that poly people are good at making up words. Despite the fact that some people still use the words primary and secondary descriptively, we discourage this use, particularly secondary, because it is confusing, and because many people find the word secondary hurtful outside of, and sometimes within, hierarchies. In this book, we only use these terms when speaking of explicitly hierarchical relationships. Service secondaries. One common feature of hierarchical relationships is the notion that the secondary partner must provide the primary couple with some form of service as compensation for being in a relationship with one of them. For instance, the secondary partner may have to babysit. We even know of a case where the secondary partner was expected to present in public as the couple's nanny. Or the service could be other domestic duties. Sex is another service that the secondary partners are often asked to provide, in cases where they are expected to be sexually involved with both members of a couple. We refer to such agreements as service secondaries, and you would be well advised to avoid them, no matter which role you would play in the structure. What's wrong with these agreements? Isn't it fair to look for partners who will want to support you, help around the house, and participate in your family life, if that's what matters to you? Well, sure, but starting out with the view that a new partner is taking something away and therefore needs to compensate by doing work for the couple is not a healthy foundation for a relationship. Let's take a deeper look at this. First, we're not talking about mutually supportive relationships where everyone pitches in and helps each other. These arrangements are non-reciprocal. If you don't see the primary couple showing up at the secondary partner's house on a Friday night to do their dishes and laundry, the service arrangement is probably one way. Second, some help-out arrangements may be perfectly reasonable at the start, particularly if the secondary partner actually likes the chore. But they can become coercive as the partners bond and the job becomes habitual. Once the relationship has become established, the secondary partner may feel he has to continue doing the work in order to pay for the continued access to intimacy. Finally, in prescribing in advance what service they expect a secondary partner to perform, the couple is objectifying any potential new partners. Service secondary arrangements enshrine the idea that the secondary partner must compensate the couple for being there. There's something inherently demeaning about telling someone they have to perform a service for you in exchange for enriching your life. If a partner doesn't add to your life, then why are you bringing her into it? If she does add to your life, then why make her work for you in order to be there? Many people do like to express their love, or have love expressed for them, through acts of service, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And many people like to go out of their way to extend themselves to a new metamour, to make them feel welcome and cared for. But if you want to know whether you're looking at a mutually supportive relationship that may include acts of service as expressions of love, or you're slipping into a hierarchical service secondary arrangement, here are some things to think about. Is what I'm looking for reciprocal? Am I ready to offer as much care and service as I am expecting in return? Is my partner free to choose the acts of service that he uses to express his love for me? Am I making access to a relationship contingent upon continued acts of service? Am I choosing partners on the basis of the service they are willing to provide? Find a primary of your own. We've discussed before that people are not need fulfillment machines and that, except in certain limited instances, the my needs aren't being met, let's find someone else approach to poly problem solving is fraught with peril. Nowhere is this more true than in the idea that if a secondary partner wants more time and attention, the solution is for him to go and find a primary of his own. Here's Franklin's story.
Bella wanted a committed, closely bonded relationship with me, but the terms of my agreement with Celeste relegated my other partners to a prescribed secondary status. Bella and I thought, seemingly reasonably, that if she had another primary partner, her needs for that kind of relationship would be met, and she would no longer need those things from me. That idea turned out to be disastrously wrong. The thing she wanted wasn't a primary, it was a closer relationship with me. Being close to other people didn't meet that need. When she did find another partner, she discovered this didn't change what she wanted from me. Our relationship ended because not being able to have her needs met damaged it beyond our ability to repair. When she ended the relationship, she was clear that she did not believe it was possible for someone to be close to me under the terms that Celeste and I wanted, regardless of whether that person had an existing primary relationship or not. I struggled to understand why. Because I was still trapped in the mindset that polyamory was something Celeste allowed me to do, and protecting the main relationship with her had to be my first priority, I could not see how I was treating Bella as an accessory to my relationship rather than as a real person. I did not realize that thinking Bella just needed a primary of her own was actually a way of saying her feelings for me were not okay and that she needed to transfer those feelings onto someone else. Bella and I had been together for 10 years when she called it off. I was devastated, but for a long time I held on to the belief that what went wrong was somehow her fault, that if she had just stayed in the space Celeste and I had set aside for her, everything would have been okay. Only much later did I understand why making that space for her and telling her to stay put inside it was not a kind or loving thing for me to do, and when I did figure that out, the pain was much worse.
If your car needs an alternator, you can go to an auto parts store and pick one off the shelf. But people are not car parts. Each of us is unique, and it's the things that make us unique that matter. Swapping one person for another in the hopes that the new person will meet the needs unfulfilled by the old really doesn't work. Hierarchy and ethics. Is it possible to practice hierarchical polyamory in a caring and ethical way? Yes, but it takes special attention to avoid hurting people. A secondary partner is in a uniquely vulnerable position and may feel she has limited recourse when problems arise. It is particularly vital to consider this whenever you make decisions that affect a secondary partner directly. This doesn't mean that consideration for the secondary partner should override any and all needs within the primary relationship. Avoid either-or thinking that if someone's needs don't come first, that must mean another's needs do. Instead, work together to give everyone space to voice their needs. There might be many ways to have certain needs met, and needs do not always have to be in conflict, even when they seem to be. Primary partners should be especially conscious of how their decisions will impact the secondary partners and take care to treat the secondary partner's needs and feelings gently and with compassion. In particular, when things get stormy in a primary relationship, it's easy to become so concerned with our own issues that we forget to pay attention to the secondary being hurt. Franklin has been guilty of this himself, and he knows how easy it can be. In Chapter 3, we introduced our Relationship Bill of Rights. It contains, we believe, standards by which to judge whether a hierarchical relationship is ethical and healthy. These rights apply to all relationships, but hierarchical relationships in particular risk abridging many of them. The following are examples of specific relationship rights that are at risk in hierarchical relationships and ways in which these rights are commonly overridden. To choose the level of involvement and intimacy you want and to revoke consent to any form of intimacy at any time. Both the pivot partner, the person in the middle, and the secondary partner in a hierarchical V structure can have this right violated if the primary partner restricts the intimacy they can choose with each other, or if the primary partner requires that the secondary partner be intimate with her too. To revoke consent to any form of intimacy at any time. This right can be violated when the primary couple keeps relevant information from the secondary partner. To hold and express differing points of view. It's common for the primary couples to shut down complaints or concerns from the secondary partner if they conflict with the primary couple's rules, or to forbid a secondary partner from attempting to renegotiate the rules. To feel all your emotions. Both the pivot and secondary partners may be subject to rules restricting what they are allowed to feel. To feel and communicate your emotions and needs. Generally speaking, rules against specific emotions are really rules against communicating feelings, since people cannot control what they feel, but only what they express. When a secondary partner does express forbidden emotions, they're often dismissed as unreal or less important than those of the primary couple. To set boundaries concerning your privacy needs. Some primary couples do not recognize the right to privacy of the members of the secondary relationship. There may, for example, be expectations that the primary partner would tell the other primary intimate details that the secondary partner considers private. To seek balance between what you give to the relationship and what is given back to you. It is common to see secondary partners expected to give things to the primary couple that are not reciprocated. To know that your partner will work with you to resolve issues that arise. Often, secondary relationships are subject to rules that were put in place before the secondary partner came on the scene. If a rule is not working for the secondary relationship, will the members of the primary relationship renegotiate? To make mistakes. There may be an expectation that a secondary relationship will be ended the first time the secondary partner makes a mistake. To decide how many partners you want and to choose your own partners. Hierarchy often includes a screening veto, discussed in the next chapter, that restricts people from selecting their own partners. To have an equal say with each of your partners in deciding the form your relationship with that partner will take. In many hierarchies, the primary couple has more say than the secondary partner in deciding this. To choose the level of time and investment you will offer to each partner. The pivot partner's ability to choose the level of investment she wants to give each of her relationships may be limited by pre-existing rules set by the primary relationship. To understand clearly any rules that will apply to your relationship before entering into it. Many secondary partners feel that they did not fully understand what they were getting into. To discuss with your partners decisions that affect you. Many primary couples make decisions about the secondary relationship, then present them as a fait accompli. To have time alone with each of your partners. Some primary couples have rules prohibiting this. To enjoy passion and special moments with each of your partners. Hierarchical relationships often have rules restricting the amount of intimacy or specialness the secondary relationship can have. To choose the level of involvement and intimacy you want with your partner's other partners. Hierarchical relationships often seek to prescribe the relationship with more than one person, sometimes even requiring the secondary partner to be sexually or romantically involved with both members of the primary couple. To seek compromise. Often the primary couple expects to dictate terms, to have relationships with people, not with relationships. The primary couple may expect the secondary partner to interact with them as a unit, limiting the individual relationships that may develop. To have plans made with your partner be respected, for instance, not changed at the last minute for trivial reasons. Primary couples often assume they are free to change plans whenever they have to. To be treated as a peer of every other person and not as a subordinate, even when differing levels of commitment or responsibility exist. Hierarchical relationships tend to be disempowering to at least the secondary partner and often to the pivot partner in the core couple as well. So, are hierarchical relationships inherently disempowering? Or can they be practiced fairly and ethically in a way that benefits everyone and does not violate the relationship bill of rights? We are hesitant to give a categorical yes or no. Because of the popularity of hierarchical poly relationships, we would like to be able to say, yes, it is possible to conduct hierarchical relationships ethically and responsibly for the benefit of everyone involved. But the truth is, in all our years of practicing polyamory, in the thousands of emails Franklin has received, and the hundreds of stories people have shared online, we have never seen a hierarchical relationship that worked well for everyone over the long term. It's common to hear people say that a hierarchical relationship works for us, and by us, they mean the primary couple. But if you look at their relationship histories, you'll often find a string of past secondary partners who were either vetoed for trying to renegotiate the rules once they became too constricting, or who left the relationship because of poor treatment. This sadly describes Franklin's history of secondary relationships during his 18 years with Celeste. Many people who have been a secondary partner in a hierarchy have sworn never to do it again. It's difficult to say that hierarchy is working when we include these people in our assessment. On the other hand, couples often complain that they just can't seem to find secondary partners who are really poly, that is, who won't want a say in the rules that govern them. When couples consistently can't find partners willing to participate in their flavor of hierarchy, it's difficult to say that hierarchy is working for them either. You do see relationship networks where people have carefully worked to maximize well-being and respect the relationship rights of everyone involved, while upholding their commitments to their partners. But in our experience, by the time someone has managed to avoid the pitfalls above and remains focused on, say, a long-standing lifetime partnership, while treating newer or less entwined partners with integrity and compassion, the structure that is left tends to no longer resemble a hierarchy. Such relationships instead begin to look like empowered relationships, the subject of Chapter 13. But first, we need to talk about a particular kind of agreement that's a keystone of many hierarchical poly relationships, the veto. Questions to ask yourself. You may encounter relationship hierarchy in one of two ways, by instituting it in one or more of your relationships, or by entering a relationship with someone who is already part of a hierarchical structure. The questions to ask yourself will differ depending on which situation you're in. If you are considering implementing a relationship hierarchy, how do I view potential new partners, both for myself and for my existing partners? Do I see them as potential problems to be managed, or do I see them as potential sources of joy to enrich my partner's life? How does my approach to hierarchy reflect that view? Are there specific assets, commitments, or people, such as children, I am seeking to protect with a hierarchy? Can I imagine other avenues for achieving that protection? Am I open to secondary relationships someday becoming primary relationships, given enough time and investment? What will I do if a secondary partner becomes dissatisfied with the rules that apply to them? Am I willing or able to involve that partner in renegotiations of the rules? If you are considering entering a hierarchy as a secondary partner, do I clearly understand both the letter and the intent of the rules that will apply to my relationship? Am I comfortable maintaining a relationship within those rules? Am I comfortable with the reasons for the rules? Do I know whether the rules that apply to my relationship are subject to change? If so, who may change them and how? What input will I have into those changes? Will the term secondary be applied to my relationship? And if so, do I understand how the primary couple is defining the word? Am I comfortable with the definition? Will it be possible for the secondary nature of my relationship to evolve into primary, if my partner and I desire that? If not, How will I feel about my relationship remaining secondary long into the future, say 10 or 15 years? 12. Veto arrangements. May your choices reflect your hopes, not your fears. Nelson Mandela. The word veto is Latin for I forbid. It refers to one person's power to prevent something from happening. In law, where the English use of the word comes from, a veto is something that happens at the end of a deliberate process. When we talk about veto in polyamorous relationships, we're talking about something very specific. The agreed-upon ability for one person to tell another, I want you to break up with your lover, and have the breakup happen. Identifying a real veto situation can at times be tricky because some people use the word veto to describe things that aren't veto by this definition. For instance, we often run into people who say we have the right to talk to our partner if one of her other relationships becomes a problem, discuss the problems we see, and ask for resolutions, which might include changes up to and including ending the relationship. We prefer to call this sort of arrangement good communication, not veto. If you have something you call veto that looks like this, then we're not talking about you. A veto, for the purpose of this discussion, is a one-sided decision to halt a relationship between two other people. It is not a negotiation or a request. The key elements of a veto are that it is unilateral, that is, only one person needs to think there's a problem, and it is binding. That is, the person exercising a veto has reason to believe the other will obey it. A veto moves the focus of control away from the people in a particular relationship and gives it to a third party. Veto arrangements are one of the most common and most zealously guarded of all the rules in hierarchical relationships. In our experience, most hierarchies include a veto arrangement, even when they include few of the other rules we've talked about. Vetoes promise the ultimate fallback. If a partner's relationship becomes too difficult, or their other lover is too unlikable, or jealousy becomes too unbearable, veto can make the problem just go away. Over the years, Franklin has received scores of emails from people who had their relationship ended by veto. These stories varied in detail, but all had one common thread. The person who was vetoed felt that the veto was unfair. The subject of veto is likely to generate controversy in any discussion about polyamory. Some people feel passionate about the value of veto. The word itself is powerful. It conjures up the feelings of empowerment and control. Even people who don't have a veto, according to our definition, will often insist on using the word veto because the word itself creates such a compelling feeling of safety. Veto of an existing relationship. For people who are subject to a veto but don't hold one, for example, the new partner of a person whose pre-existing partner has a veto, the word veto is just as powerful, but often it is powerfully negative. It creates an environment where no matter what you do or what kind of investment you make, your relationship can be ripped away at a moment's notice without discussion or appeal. It summons an image of the sword of Damocles, always dangling over the relationship by a thread, ready to fall at any misstep. This creates an environment where it's nearly impossible to feel safe in that relationship. We have both been affected by vetoes. Eve had a relationship vetoed by another person. Franklin has been vetoed and has also had someone veto a partner of his. Vetoes are like nuclear weapons. They may keep others in line, but their use tends to forever alter the landscape. Here is Franklin's story.
For Celeste, veto was a security blanket, a way to stop relationships that threatened her position as the number one person in my life. She used that veto to end my relationship with Elaine. At the time, I had known Elaine for about 5 years and been in a relationship with her for about 3. Our relationship was incredibly powerful and passionate. We were very well matched as partners, and our sexual connection was extraordinary. This was hard for Celeste to see. Watching a long-term partner have an intense, passionate connection with someone else can be scary. The day Celeste exercised her veto, I was driving to work with my partner Amber, who worked from the same office. Celeste called me to demand that I end my relationship with Elaine immediately and never contact her again. As Celeste instructed, I called Elaine and broke up with her immediately. I was devastated. I remember pulling into the parking lot of a fast food restaurant with Amber, unable to stop crying. I was so hurt and upset that I never made it to the office that afternoon. Amber wrote about that day. I have never seen him break down like that, before or since. His body broke down into convulsions of crying. I don't think I've ever seen him in so much pain. To this day, I still do not completely understand why Celeste made the choice she did. When she used the veto, I felt violated. I was angry, not just that she could veto a partner I'd been with for so long, but that she could do it in a way that allowed no argument for or defense of my relationship with Elaine. My control over my own romantic life had been ripped away from me. Even though I had agreed to give Celeste this veto power, that didn't change the loss of control I felt when she used it. The sense of violation and my feelings of anger seeped into my relationship with Celeste. None of the theoretical, abstract discussions we'd had about veto prepared me for the raw emotional impact of being told to end a relationship with someone I loved. I saw for the first time how damaging veto was, and I resolved not to allow this to happen again, to me or to any of my partners. I told Celeste I would not accept another veto. My relationship with Celeste never fully recovered from the veto. We divorced less than 2 years later. Many other factors were in play, as always in the disintegration of a decades-long relationship, but that veto was like an earthquake at sea, which initiated a tidal wave that would eventually consume everything Celeste and I had built together.
Many hierarchical relationships have a veto provision that can be exercised at any time, even after another relationship has been well established. This kind of veto is popular because it seems to provide a safety switch to shut down a relationship that becomes too intense or threatening. But that sense of safety can carry a very high price. We both have seen many couples who have executed a veto only to break up shortly thereafter. Anytime we choose to break our partner's heart, the damage to our own relationship may be permanent. When a partner of yours vetoes another partner, you actually do have a choice. You can either end the relationship that's being vetoed, or you can say, "No, I refuse to accept this veto." But neither option is likely to lead anywhere constructive. If you say, "No, I refuse to accept this," your partner, who has used the veto, now has a choice to make. Stay in the relationship and sulk, leave. Whatever the choice the person makes, bitterness is pretty much guaranteed. Here's Eve's story.
My relationship with Ray ended when his wife vetoed me, but it wasn't the veto that ended it. Ray and I had a long-distance relationship, and his wife and I had little contact. Ray and I had been involved for close to 2 years when he told me that I had been vetoed, several months earlier. He had continued to visit me, have sex with me, and have almost daily contact with me, without his wife's knowledge. When I learned of this, I told him I couldn't see him anymore. I am ashamed to say it took me nearly 24 hours to come to that decision. It was painful enough that after 2 years with me, Ray wouldn't stand up to his wife to defend our relationship. But it was equally bad that I was put in the position of implementing the veto that Ray did not have the courage to either accept or refuse. Rather than take responsibility for the situation and stand up to either one of us, he chose to lie to us both.
Even if your partner uses a veto, responsibility for the breakup is still yours. If your relationship has been vetoed, it's easy to say, "I'm ending this relationship because my partner made me do it." Franklin did this when Celeste used her veto. In reality, the ethical responsibility belonged only to him. Screening veto. Not all vetoes work to cancel an existing relationship. Some people use what might be called a screening veto. This means a potential new relationship may be vetoed before it becomes established, but not after. In a newspaper column in 2007, kink and polyamory writer Mistress Matisse described this as starting the feedback before emotions and slippery bits get involved. A screening veto is safer than a post-relationship veto in that it is less likely to create a sense of violation. However, even this variety of veto can have damaging consequences. Here's Franklin's story.
Meadow and I met a few years ago under strange and complicated circumstances. We hit it off at once. We both felt drawn to each other, and soon after we met, we went on a date. It was one of the best first dates I've ever had. There wasn't anything unusual about the date itself. We sat in a restaurant and talked, but we both had an absolutely fantastic time chatting about everything from movies to neurobiology. The chemistry between us was delightful. After the date, I took her home and met her husband. We spoke briefly, and then I went home. I emailed her the next day to let her know I'd had a delightful time and I was looking forward to seeing her again. No response. I texted her a couple of days later, and again no reply. Huh, I thought. I guess she didn't have as good a time as I thought. Months later, I found out through mutual friends that Meadow had been so thrilled and excited by our date, and so giddy at the thought of dating me, that her husband vetoed me on the spot. What's more, he forbade her ever to speak to me again, even to tell me I'd been vetoed. I would never have found out if we hadn't had overlapping circles of friends.
This veto experienced by Franklin seems to have come entirely from a place of fear and threat. It can be intimidating to see a partner excited about a new relationship, especially when we feel insecure ourselves. All the demons start whispering in our ears. What if I'm not good enough? What if this person is more exciting than I am? A screening veto has problems because, like all vetoes, it tends to end conversations rather than start them. Had Meadow's husband chosen to talk about his feelings rather than using a veto, their relationship might have improved. But it can be hard to say, wow, seeing you excited like this makes me feel insecure. Let's talk about what that means and how we can work together to strengthen and support our relationship until what we have brings you this much joy. It's much easier to say, I don't want you to see him again. While it's not as damaging to veto a person before a relationship begins, depriving a partner of a source of joy is still a dangerous thing to do. When we see a partner clearly excited about something and take that thing away, we risk undermining our partner's happiness, and that too is likely to damage our relationship. It might be tempting to look at the examples above and call them abuses of veto, rather than situations where veto is useful and appropriate. We disagree. The problem is that nobody with veto power believes he uses it capriciously. We all tend to be the heroes of our own stories, acting on motives wise and pure. The problem with veto is not that some use it inappropriately. The problem is that it tends to cause damage, no matter how it is used. And sometimes veto becomes a way to defend our own dysfunctions and entrench them. You may hear the following idea in poly circles, that you should only add relationships that enhance your existing ones, or that you should screen new partners to make sure their communication and relationship style mesh with your existing relationship. That does seem like a good way to avoid drama and promote stability, but just as often it can lead to enabling behaviors. You can easily end up constructing an echo chamber in your existing relationship where dysfunctional relationship patterns go unchallenged. But what if we have reason to be concerned that the new person is disruptive, manipulative, a bad influence, emotionally unstable, or dangerous to our partner? We've heard all these and more reasons why someone had to use veto. After all, our beloved is all caught up in twitterpation, aglow with hormones, and can't think clearly. It's true. We all gloss over flaws in the flush of a new crush. Isn't it our partner's job to see with eyes unclouded when we are blinded? To see warning signs and tell us? Well, yes, but there's no reason to imagine that the veto-wielding partner is any more objective than the twitter-pated partner. After all, it's scary to watch your partner get distracted by new shiny. And when you're scared, you don't make wise decisions either. Which isn't to say that the veto-wielding partner is always wrong and the infatuated partner is always right. There's just no reason to assume that one is necessarily more right than the other. The only way through the swamp is to communicate openly about whatever concerns or misgivings you have, and then to let the person in the relationship be the one to make the decision. because even if his choice of partner is a mistake, it is his mistake to make. Screening veto agreements deprive us of our ability to make our own mistakes and learn and grow from them. Early in Eve's relationship with Peter, they talked about using a veto as part of their transition from monogamy to polyamory. But after they discussed it for a while, they both agreed that a veto might reduce their opportunities to learn. Here's Eve's story.
Peter has been in a relationship with Gwen for over 5 years. He started seeing her just a couple of months after he began his relationship with Cleo, and while he was still traveling frequently to look after his mum. I was still adjusting to all the change and was completely unprepared for him to begin another new relationship. Moreover, I didn't like Gwen. When I met her, I had difficulty understanding her. I just had a gut feeling I didn't really like her, and I didn't feel like I was going to enjoy having her around. I told Peter so, but he continued to see Gwen. If Peter and I had had a screening veto, I might have vetoed Gwen. And that would have been a huge mistake, because in this case, Peter has proven to be a much better judge than I was of what will make him happy and what sort of person Gwen is. She has been an overwhelmingly positive addition to both our lives, and a stable, secure, and supportive partner for Peter. I am immensely grateful not only for her presence in Peter's life, but for the agreement Peter and I made early on that we would not have the right to choose whom the other could become involved with.
Ethical problems with veto. There's nothing wrong in trying to manage risk. We do it every time we put on a seatbelt. Managing risk through veto, though, raises serious ethical concerns. It violates both of our core ethical principles. The people in the relationship are more important than the relationship, and don't treat people as things. How does a veto treat people as things? A veto of an existing relationship makes a person expendable. It does not give her input whether or not her own relationship is ended. While it's true that even in monogamous relationships, the person being broken up with doesn't get a say in the matter. The polyveto situation is unique. Here, a third party, who is not actually in the relationship, is ending something that both of the people in it still want. A veto arrangement also makes the relationship more important than the people in it, because it requires that a relationship be ended without consideration for whether it is healthy